KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The politicization of the Department of Justice seems like it's complete.
1 month into the Trump Justice Department, is a pattern emerging of prosecutors walking away from certain cases?
It's Tuesday, February 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead this hour, thousands of federal employees have been fired in recent days.
We meet two of them who say they will fight back.
I gave blood, sweat, and tears to this country for 20 years, and to continue service to the federal government and doing what I was trained to do by them, I kind of feel like I was just thrown out like a piece of trash.
Also, new fiction about a love story set in Harlem in the 1920s.
Well, there's a question to be asked. Like, would the Harlem Renaissance have happened without their affair?
And the Academy Awards are less than 2 weeks away.
Critic Bob Mondello has you covered with reviews of two contenders for Best Picture.
That's ahead after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump today blamed Ukraine for the ongoing war between it and Russia. That war began in 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine, 8 years after Russia annexed the Crimean Peninsula. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more on today's talks.
American and Russian delegations met in Saudi Arabia to discuss ending the war in Ukraine. Ukraine was not invited to those talks, nor were Ukrainian allies in Europe. At a press conference at his Mar-a-Lago club, the president blamed Ukraine for the nearly three-year-long war.
And I think I have the power to end this war. And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
Trump made similar comments on the campaign trail. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said his country will not recognize any peace deal made without their participation. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
More than 10,000 federal employees have been fired from their jobs. Most of them were still on probationary status. As NPR's Andrea Hsu explains, lawyers are exploring class action lawsuits to challenge those dismissals.
Federal employees typically have to get through 1 or 2 years of probation before they have full civil service job protections. Still, attorneys say even without those protections, they may still have a case. Many of the workers fired were told that their performance failed to demonstrate that their employment was in the public interest. David Branch is a longtime employment attorney in Washington, D.C.
If you can prove that this statement is false, you probably have a claim for infringement upon your good name and reputation under the Fifth Amendment.
The Trump administration says the terminations are about cutting waste and making government more efficient. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The U.S. Postal Service plans to step down. As NPR's Hanzilo Wong reports, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy set to end a controversial term that began in 2020 during President Trump's first administration.
In a public letter, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy is asking the Postal Service Board of Directors to start looking for someone to replace him. It's unclear when DeJoy will step down, but he says in the letter he's committed to a transition that is, quote, the least impactful to the Postal Service and the American people. DeJoy was appointed to lead the Postal Service during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic and has overseen the rise of voting by mail for two presidential elections. In 2021, DeJoy rolled out a 10-year reorganization plan in an attempt to bring financial stability to the postal system. Critics of the plan, however, say that consolidating mail processing centers and other changes have slowed service, especially in rural communities. Anzila Wong, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks, after wobbling around a bit today, ended up closing higher. The broader market moving past its previous record high. The Dow gained 10 points to close at 44,556. The Nasdaq was up 14 points. The S&P 500 also gained 14 points. This is NPR. A leader with the militant group Hamas says plans call for another group of hostage releases this week. Hamas says it will return the bodies of four deceased hostages Thursday and will then release six living hostages Saturday. Both releases in exchange for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners and for Israel allowing long-requested mobile homes and construction equipment into Gaza. Native American activist Leonard Peltier was released from a federal prison in Florida after serving nearly 50 years in connection with the murder of two FBI agents on a South Dakota reservation. Member station WUSF Steve Newborn reports.
Peltier's life sentence was commuted to indefinite house arrest in the last days of Joe Biden's presidency. One of his attorneys, activist Chase Iron Eyes, said Peltier will be honored during a ceremony in his native North Dakota before being confined to his home.
He's going to be welcomed as a hero in his homeland. We are going to celebrate Leonard Peltier in the same way that we celebrate Nelson Mandela.
At his trial, Peltier said he fired his gun at the federal agents in self-defense, but didn't kill them. For NPR News, I'm Steve Newborn in St. Petersburg, Florida.
For small businesses, answering the chicken or the egg question, well, it is definitely the egg, at least in terms of what's hurting the bottom line the most. Restaurants, bakeries, and bodegas, all of which use or sell eggs, say right now in many cases they're absorbing the price hikes as a cost of doing business. Eggs nationwide are now averaging just under $5 a dozen, largely because of the avian flu outbreak. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We are now about 1 month into President Trump's term, and Justice Department veterans are starting to notice a pattern. They say the DOJ seems to be more lenient with people who appear loyal to the president. NPR Justice Correspondent Gary Johnson has been reporting on some of those cases. Hi there.
Hey there.
So we're talking obviously about politically sensitive cases. What exactly are you hearing from people both in and outside the Justice Department?
Stephen Salzberg spent years at Justice under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. He says alarm is actually an understatement about what's happening there. Prosecutors seem to be backing away from cases against people with ties to Donald Trump.
There are patterns that we haven't really seen in the past. None of the patterns inspire a lot of confidence that the department is being even-handed in its approach to cases.
Salzberg says this actually started on Inauguration Day with Trump's clemency for more than 1,500 people who took part in the Capitol riot. He says it looks like Trump wanted to cut those people a break because they were acting on his behalf.
I will inject a reminder here that Trump, of course, was himself investigated by the Justice Department, was charged twice by the Justice Department. Prosecutors dropped those charges against him after he won the election in November. Is that experience echoing through the Justice Department now?
It absolutely is. After Trump returned to the White House, prosecutors abandoned their obstruction case against two of his aides at the Mar-a-Lago resort. Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira allegedly helped Trump hide classified documents from the FBI. And Trump's spoken a lot lately about how the Justice Department went after him. He says that gave him an appreciation for the plight of other politicians accused of wrongdoing. That's really showed. In recent weeks, DOJ dropped a case against former Nebraska Congressman Jeff Fortenberry. Prosecutors in Nashville withdrew from an investigation against Republican Congressman Andy Ogles. Ogles, of course, had introduced a bill that would clear the way for Trump to serve a third term in office. And then on Friday, the DOJ moved to dismiss the case against New York Mayor Eric Adams.
Stay with the Mayor Adams case for a sec, because that's a big one, and I know the fallout is continuing. What is the latest?
Seven prosecutors quit rather than move to drop that case. They said it looked like an unlawful quid pro quo. Adams and his lawyer have flatly denied that. But the judge in the case, Dale Ho, has ordered both sides to court Wednesday in New York to explain why the prosecution's being dismissed. And meanwhile, more than 900 former Justice Department prosecutors signed a letter to salute the people still at Justice for responding to ethical challenges with courage and conviction. One of the people who signed is Peter Zeidenberg. He says senior lawyers at Justice did not seem to hide they were acting for political reasons to secure Eric Adams' cooperation with immigration agents.
The politicization of the Department of Justice seems like it's complete.
But the chief of staff to the current attorney general says this DOJ wants to focus on its core function of prosecuting dangerous criminals, not pursuing politically motivated witch hunts.
That reminds me of something that current Attorney General, this is Pam Bondi, something she said, which is that she wants to go after weaponization.
She does. Bondi seems to be focused on people who help bring cases against Donald Trump. Harvard Law Professor Jack Goldsmith wrote this week, this all seems to be doublespeak, part of a playbook to weaponize DOJ law enforcement like never before against Trump's perceived enemies. And the fear of many of my sources is that the DOJ will, on one hand, move to help Trump's friends get out of trouble, and on the other, use its vast powers of investigation and prosecution against people who have criticized the president.
And Pierre's Carrie Johnson there. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
A coalition of privacy watchdogs and unions has gone to court trying to block Elon Musk and his Doge team from getting their hands on taxpayers' sensitive information at the IRS. This is just the latest attempt to stop Musk and his allies from tapping into computer networks across the federal government with the full backing of President Trump. And Pierre Scott Horsley joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hi, good to be with you.
So why are people trying to stop the Doge team from digging through the IRS data?
Well, think about the last time you filed your taxes and everything you revealed to the government. Not only how much money you make, but what your family looks like, maybe some details about your health, the charities you give money to. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of potentially sensitive personal information. Nina Olson used to work for the IRS. She now heads a nonprofit group called the Center for Taxpayer Rights. She says when people voluntarily open up to the government in filing their taxes like that, they expect the information to be kept confidential.
They're telling the IRS their information, and if they can't trust that it's being kept close to the chest, then why would they go ahead and file?
That's why Olson's group and others are now asking a federal judge to block Elon Musk's team from accessing any personal tax information. And if it's too late for that, then to delete any data they've already hoovered up at the IRS. Doge employees have come knocking at a variety of other government agencies, including the Treasury Department, Health and Human Services, USAID. But while the playbook is similar, this new lawsuit argues tax data is different and enjoys special privacy protections under the law.
Generally speaking, how tightly guarded is this data?
It's in the vault. You know, it's not sitting in some open filing cabinet where anybody at IRS can peek at it. There are strict limits on who can access the data and for what purposes. And any violations taken very seriously. Last year, a former IRS contractor was sentenced to 5 years in prison for leaking tax information about Donald Trump and other wealthy individuals to the news media. Nina Olson says even though she worked at IRS for almost two decades, she never had access to the data system that Doge is trying to get its hands on.
There is a lot of vigilance on that. Employees go through mandatory annual training on the confidentiality of return information. It is just drummed into them.
Now, it wasn't always like that. Up until the mid-70s, it was actually pretty easy for the president or other members of the executive branch to tap into that tax information. But Congress cracked down in 1976, and that was partly in response to concerns that President Nixon had improperly used tax information to help his friends avoid close scrutiny of their finances while sicking IRS auditors on his enemies.
And speaking of personal information that the federal government has, the Doge team is also said to be combing through records at the Social Security Administration. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a similar showdown. And here again, the Trump administration says they're on the lookout for misspent funds. Here's White House spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt on Fox News.
They suspect that there are tens of millions of deceased people who are receiving fraudulent Social Security payments.
Now, people who actually know something about Social Security say that's just a gross exaggeration. Fraud does happen, but the agency's own inspector general combed through 7 years of records and found less than 1% of payments were made in error. But as with tax records, Social Security has a lot of people's sensitive personal information on file, and privacy advocates recoil at the idea of Elon Musk's deputies digging through that data without a lot of guardrails. In fact, the Washington Post and others have reported that the acting commissioner of Social Security quit over the weekend in protest.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
People like to talk. We're unique in the animal kingdom in terms of how much we communicate and the kinds of information we discuss. Scientists are trying to understand how this special trait evolved at the genetic level. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on what happened recently when researchers gave mice the human version of one particular gene.
If someone asked you what kind of sound a mouse makes, you'd probably go squeak.
But mice also make some sounds in the ultrasonic range that humans can't hear. If you process those sounds so that we can hear them, it's a lot like bird song. Eric Jarvis is a researcher at Rockefeller University in New York. He says mouse pups chirp when they're taken away from their mothers, and as adults, male mice string long sequences of these chirps together.
And they'll sing them to the females as a courtship behavior.
Recently, Jarvis teamed up with some other researchers at Rockefeller University to study one particular gene. This gene is found in living creatures from mammals to birds, but there's one particular variant that's found only in people. When they put that uniquely human variant into mice, it subtly changed the vocalizations made by babies and adult males. Jarvis says their analysis showed that the mouse songs became more complex.
So the fact that we had a change in the vocal behavior was really exciting.
He says this gene could be related to speech and language, although it's clearly not the only language gene.
I don't think that one gene is going to be responsible, poof, and you got spoken language, right?
Still, this gene is especially intriguing because it's active in the brain, and this variant seems to be only found in modern humans. Robert Darnell is a neuroscientist, also at Rockefeller University. He says they've looked at genetic information in databases and found that this variant is present in almost every single person from around the world, but it's not found in chimps or extinct human species like Neanderthals.
This is a human language gene that changed and switched early in the development of Homo sapiens.
A report on the findings appears in the journal Nature Communications, and it's got the attention of other scientists interested in the genetic underpinnings of language. Cedric Books is with the Catalan Institute for Advanced Studies and Research and the University of Barcelona. He says it's a real advance.
It's one gene among many still to be uncovered in a complex network that influence this and make possible this capacity we have.
He cautions, though, that it's hard to make a jump from mouse vocalizations to human speech. A mouse is not your typical vocal learner.
It produces vocalizations, but they are mostly innately constrained. So it's not like us.
He says humans are special in how we communicate, and knowing the list of genes involved in language could tell us something about how humans came to be who we are. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ping Huang. A new book is a reader's delight for the who's who it features in its pages. Harlem Rhapsody is a novel that serves as a love letter to the heart of Black creativity and possibility in the 1920s during the Harlem Renaissance. And at the center of that love letter is a love story, the hidden relationship between Black activist W.E.B. Du Bois and Jesse Redmond Fawcett, writer and literary editor of the NAACP's magazine, The Crisis. Victoria Christopher Murray brings all of us to life in her new novel, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Jesse Redmond Fawcett. When did you first come across her writing, and when did you decide that she had the potential for her own star turn in historical fiction?
I really kind of took this methodically. I wanted to write about a woman, and a woman that I'd want to spend the next 2 years with.
Right.
And I thought about, where would I want this woman to live? I thought about New York. I thought about the time period. And that got me to the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I started digging in, looking for the women of the Harlem Renaissance, that I became committed to this, because I couldn't find any. Every time you looked up, and I was just doing surface research at the time,
mm-hmm.
it was always about the men. And it was Langston Hughes, when he was saying she was the midwife of the Harlem Renaissance, that I found Jesse Redmond Fawcett.
Yeah. The book basically opens as she's about to start her new job as literary editor at The Crisis, which was a job created for her by W.E.B. Du Bois. Tell us about their relationship as the book starts.
Yes. So it's really interesting, because I never meant to write anything salacious. I never meant to write a controversial novel, but I will always tell the truth.
Mm.
And Du Bois was the editor of The Crisis magazine. He was the founder and the editor. And when he started thinking about maybe perhaps expanding the magazine, that's when he called upon Jesse Redmond Fawcett. Now, he'd known her for over a decade at that point. She was the first Black woman to graduate from Cornell University,
mm-hmm.
the first Black woman to graduate Phi Beta Kappa. And he knew her because he was acting as a mentor to her. They had kind of, I guess, what we call today a pen pal kind of relationship. And they met many years later in 1914, and they were both smitten with each other and began a more intimate relationship.
I feel like the emotional core of a lot of the novel is this relationship between Fawcett and Du Bois. And like, what does sort of looking at his infidelities and her relationship with him, what kind of insight does that give the reader into his life and Fawcett's life and the world around them?
Well, you know, there's a question to be asked. Like, would the Harlem Renaissance have happened without their affair?
Mm.
It's really interesting, because I had considered writing the book without their affair. I said, let me see if I could do that, because I really wanted it focused on this woman who ignited the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
But none of it could have happened without their affair. Their affair was the reason that he brought her to New York. Their affair was the reason he encouraged her in certain ways. Their affair was the reason that she even finished her own first novel. And so I felt that I had to write the book with the affair to tell the complete story, but to tell them as complete people. They were these two extraordinary people who were doing something very ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Reading this historical fiction was so fun, because it just felt like, you know, who's going to appear next? There was Langston Hughes, there was Claude McKay, there was Nella Larsen, there were so many more. And it's just this revolving door of Black writers, because Fawcett was so key in bringing them to prominence. As you mentioned earlier, people even called her one of the midwives of the Harlem Renaissance. Can you describe some of these relationships between Jesse and the writers that she worked with?
Not only did Jesse discover all of these writers, not only did she edit them, but she mentored them. County Cullen was about 16. Langston Hughes was 17 when he first reached out to her. Nella Larson had just gotten married. Gwendolyn Bennett was in college when she met Jesse, and I could go on. The list goes on and on and on. Like, Langston Hughes came to New York wanting to be a writer, but he was at Columbia University in their engineering program because that was the only way his father would pay for it. And Jesse was really instrumental in his life and helping guide him through the racism that he experienced at Columbia. And it was that way with all the authors. They had different issues in their life, but she was always there to help them, guide them through the next step.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a taste of that literary world that Fawcett helped create. Here is a clip of Langston Hughes reading one of his early poems, The Negro Speaks of Rivers.
I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers.
How much of a poetry buff were you before diving into this book?
That's a very good question. I can't say that I was a poetry buff at all, but I became one afterwards because these poets told such complete stories in 4, 5, 6 lines. I need 400 pages to tell a story. And I was just amazed because I had to study their words. And I also wanted to study the timing of this. Like, for example, this poem was the very first poem that he wrote that was put into the Crisis magazine. They didn't do this on purpose, but it came out at the same time as the Tulsa riots. And so that was just such an interesting situation where he was talking about his soul is as deep as the rivers and what was going on in Tulsa at the time. And people were going to read his poem as they were also reading about the riots.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that I loved from reading the notes in the back of your book is that you said that you've read every issue of The Crisis from 1919 to 1925 to get the language of the times right. Yes. What did you find, and what did you use in the novel from that?
Oh, I mean, everything. I also wanted to read it because those were the issues that Jesse was the editor. And I used all of their language. They were also very formal. You know, they didn't think about things. They pondered things. My friend said after they started reading this book, they were flabbergasted all the time. And those kinds of, they had to sit back and ponder a few things themselves. So I really wanted people to be drawn back into 1920. That was very important to me. I wanted people to feel like they were in Harlem. I wanted people to feel like they were really listening to these people, speaking to these people.
That's Victoria Christopher Murray. Her new novel is Harlem Rhapsody. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this.
I've got Harlem on my mind, and I'm longing to be low down, and my parlez-vous.
This is NPR News.
As German voters head to the polls, the country's economy is still in a recession.
Globalization is in retreat. Chinese want to produce for themselves. Americans want to produce for themselves. The euro is still there, okay. We have to take care of our own military now, and the cheap energy supplies from Russia are gone as well.
That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Two recent school shootings are changing the way some experts think about those who carry them out and their motivations.
That is a considerably different target range than most of the radicalization time targets that we've seen in the past from the neo-fascist movements.
That story after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Ukraine's president says he's rescheduling a trip to Saudi Arabia following today's U.S.-Russia talks. NPR's Joanna Kakissis tells us that President Zelensky says he wants to be an equal partner in any negotiation to end Russia's nearly three-year-old war, even as Washington and Moscow appear to be resetting their relations.
Speaking to reporters in Istanbul during an official visit, Zelensky said Ukraine wants the war to end more than anyone, but with a fair deal. You can discuss whatever you want, Zelensky said, but you cannot make a decision about ending the war in Ukraine without Ukraine. He says Russia is pushing for Ukraine to decrease the size of its military and accept the loss of occupied territories. We did not agree to this during our most difficult moments, Ukraine's leader said. Why would we do so now? The Trump administration's special envoy for Ukraine and Russia is expected in Kyiv on Thursday. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
At least two deaths have been attributed to severe flooding in southern West Virginia. Curtis Tate of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrissey thanked those who provided assistance in mountain communities hit hard by the weekend's floods.
Local citizens were helping, donating water. People from across the state were helping out, and people from as far away as Texas.
Morrissey requested a major disaster declaration from President Donald Trump on Monday. West Virginia's congressional delegation has also sent a letter to Trump and the Federal Emergency Management Agency requesting disaster assistance for 13 counties. FEMA personnel are already on the ground in West Virginia, and Trump approved a disaster declaration Sunday for neighboring Kentucky. For NPR News, I'm Curtis Tate in Charleston, West Virginia.
And you're listening to NPR. Researchers are interested in what makes humans unique, so they recently investigated a generic variant that's only found in Homo sapiens. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce explains.
Some of the sounds made by mice are ultrasonic calls. If you bring those sounds into the range that humans can hear, it sounds like bird song. That singing became subtly more varied and complex when researchers genetically altered mice to give them a particular gene variant that's found only in modern humans. Bob Darnell is with Rockefeller University.
This is a human language gene that changed and switched early in the development of Homo sapiens.
The findings are described in the journal Nature Communications. Researchers say this is just one of what is likely to be many genes involved in the evolution of human speech. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
After leading the U.S. Postal Service for 5 years, Louis DeJoy is planning to resign as Postmaster General. The former logistics executive and Republican donor began his tenure in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic and saw marked surges in mail-in ballots during two presidential elections. He developed a 10-year plan to modernize the Postal Service after getting more funding from the Biden administration. A rocky day of trading on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments, As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Subaru, who along with its retailers is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More than 10,000 federal employees have been fired since last week, mainly those who were in their first or second year on the job. Such probationary employees lack job protections. Now attorneys are preparing to file class action lawsuits. NPR's Andrea Hsu talked with two workers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture who are prepared to join the fight.
Michelle Kirchner was a postdoc based out of the USDA's Bee Lab in Logan, Utah.
I was working directly with farmers and growers of alfalfa.
Alfalfa, what dairy cows eat. She was helping the farmers figure out how to control pests while not harming the pollinators, the kind of research that's not usually in the crosshairs of political fights.
Just because it's people's food and you shouldn't mess with people's food.
And then there's Derek Copeland, a retired Air Force veteran who spent much of his military career in a canine unit. Last year, he took those skills to the USDA's National Detector Dog Training Center in Noonan, Georgia.
We train the dogs to find agricultural products that are not supposed to come in from other countries.
He also trains the handlers, the officers from Customs and Border Protection who patrol airports and ports of entry along the border.
They will screen bags, cars, passengers, cargo warehouses.
The dogs sniff out products that carry disease, things that could wreak havoc on
our whole food system.
Copeland and Kirchner were both in their first year at USDA. She had about 2 months left in her probationary period. He had 11 days. Last Friday, they got pretty much the same termination letter. It said,
based on my performance, I had not demonstrated that my further employment would be in the public interest.
We don't feel that it's in the public interest to keep you on.
Both found the language shocking and offensive.
It's objectively not true.
In her 10 months on the job, Kirchner had received only positive performance reviews. She and her colleague even won a $25,000 grant to dig in more on protecting pollinators. Their proposal was chosen by the alfalfa growers themselves.
They were very excited about it. I had many of them tell me that personally.
Copeland had also received stellar performance reviews.
Everything was great and successfully meets, and there was no issues at all.
And this is why they and others plan to sue. David Branch thinks they'd have a case. He's a longtime employment attorney in Washington, D.C. He says probationary employees, like all Americans, have due process rights under the Fifth Amendment. There are things the government can't do.
They can't tarnish your reputation. They can't infringe upon your liberty interest. You have a liberty interest in your name, in your reputation.
The challenge, Branch says, will be convincing a judge that the termination letters citing inadequate performance are defamatory. He's advising federal employees to gather any feedback or comments to prove their point. The Trump administration says these terminations are all about cutting waste and making the government more efficient. To Branch, that doesn't make sense.
Probationary employees are usually the most industrious employees there. I mean, these folks know that they have a year to prove themselves, some folks 2 years, and if they don't, they can be terminated for any reason.
Michelle Kirchner says her coworkers in the Logan Bee Lab are all deeply committed to improving U.S. agriculture. It's why they're out there in the alfalfa fields in the heat of the summer.
There's no shade because it's just alfalfa as far as the eye can see. The sun just beats down on you all day and there are just bugs everywhere.
And Derek Copeland is equally committed to giving back to his country.
I gave blood, sweat, and tears to this country for 20 years and to continue service to the federal government and doing what I was trained to do by them, which is train dogs. I kind of feel like I was just thrown out like a piece of trash.
Neither Copeland nor Kirchner is ready to leave their job behind. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
It has been over 25 years since the shootings at Columbine High School. And since then, school shootings have become an ever-present reality, a reality that students and school districts prepare for. Two recent school shootings highlight a new twist in our understanding of these incidents. Experts say these attacks fall within a growing and poorly understood category of terrorism. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us. Hey there.
Hey, Scott.
So both of these shootings were murder-suicides. Can you refresh us on some of the other key details?
Yes, the first of these was in Madison, Wisconsin, back in December. Natalie Rupnow, who went by Samantha, was a freshman at Abundant Life Christian School, and before taking her own life, she killed another student and a substitute teacher coordinator. The other shooting was at Antioch High School in Nashville last month. Solomon Henderson killed another student and himself. Now, some analysts who focus on extremism and terrorism have been looking closely at these incidents, and they told me that they fall into a relatively new, quickly growing category that they call non-ideological or post-ideological terrorism.
I think a lot of people might hear non-ideological terrorism and have a lot of questions about what exactly that means.
Yeah, I mean, so what it means is that there's no clear ideological agenda behind the violence. And that's in contrast to other kinds of terrorism that we're more familiar with, like radical Islamist terrorism or white nationalist terrorism. Mm-hmm. Now, there are themes that show in both of these cases. One is a deep misanthropy. These teens were both harboring a real hatred for humanity. And another is a fascination that they had with people who've committed mass killings in the past. But honestly, Scott, those traits don't really explain why they moved into a headspace of planning violence themselves.
Okay, so then how are experts making sense of all of this, given all of that?
Well, they're starting with these teens' obsessions with mass killers. There's an online community devoted to this called the True Crime Community, but it's not one where you'll see explicit calls to violence. Now, one expert I spoke to says his team at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue has connected it to at least 7 school shooting plots in 2024 alone. And the thinking is that other darker online communities are increasingly interplaying with true crime spaces, you know, ones that organize around ideas of violence and societal decay. Here's Matthew Kreiner of the Accelerationism Research Consortium.
Most of the individuals who are targeted for this are falling in the range